I think there's a couple little things we might want to talk about. Rather, I would rather say than the history of AA, I'd say the heritage of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I were to change the title, because there's a few little things that I think we know about superficially, but that are, when you think about them, are just staggering. Duffy, the other day when he was talking, said something to the effect that somebody asked him, how did we get here? You know, how did we get here? He meant by the plane, and Duff talks about how he drank and went to hell. And the other point is, how did we get here? How will we happen to be sitting in this room safe and sane and sober when the world is full of people who isn't? And incidentally, I have one more thing. It's none of my business to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. This gentleman right here, would you stand up? This is the secretary of the local AA group, not you, you. We don't want an ovation, just a hand, if you don't mind, for cutting into my time. Nice to have you here. But AA is here on a very, very tenuous set of funny little things that should never have happened. Now, we all know basically, most of them, I'm sure we do know the basic story about this wealthy family in the East who had this son whom they loved, but who was one of those people who drank too much, and they finally, in their desperation, looked up the best doctors they could find in the world, psychiatrist and doctor, and sent them to Switzerland, to this world's best-known psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist took him in and identified him as having severe emotional problems, kept him in the sanitarium for a year, and worked on him, replaced his mind and body as well as he could, thought he had a good chance now to go out. He never even got into the ship before the guy was face down, drunk again in his own vomit. His family was appalled, and they cut hold of the doctor, and they sent him back and said, oh, Roland, go back to the doctor. Dr. Jung, take Roland back. And Roland went back to Switzerland, and the doctor gave him some bad news. And he said, you can't come back, Dr. Roland. He said, in effect, I have misdiagnosed your case. It's my fault. I thought you had severe emotional problems. It turns out that I believe now that you are what is known as an alcoholic, and I cannot help you. And I don't know of any place in the world that can help you. Imagine that, not very many years ago. In my lifetime, that happened. And Roland, of course, this is not very fun to hear. And he, in effect, said, what am I going to do? And the doctor said, well, the only possible help I've ever heard is some cases like yours have a form of spiritual transcendence where they have a deep and intense change of the spiritual condition. He said, but you can't get it, you can't order it, you can't study for it. It just seems to happen. And the chances are almost infinitesimal, but that's the best chance you got. Well, Roland was a little taken aback by this, of course. You know, he had to die. In a sense, the doctor told him about what a man would think today. He said, you have AIDS. Because there's no way out. There may be a miracle cure, but nobody knows what it is. And so he stayed in Europe, and there was a group at that time, as most of us know, called the Oxford Movement. That's the first funny little coincidence in a way, because the Oxford Movement was not it was not really a long-term movement. It was just in the right place at the right time. It started in 1908, as some of you know, a young Episcopalian minister felt that Christianity was getting too blasé. And the original aim of the Oxford Movement was the First Century Christian Association. He wanted to have people get back to that zeal that the first century Christians had. And he was in England, he was very active around Oxford, so it became known as the Oxford Movement. And it stayed that way till the 30s. Till this time, it was at the height of its power. Shortly thereafter, Dr. Buckman started evidencing great admiration for Nazi Germany and their efficiency. And after that, Oxford University asked them to stop using the name Oxford in the Oxford group. So he changed it to moral rearmament in the late 1930s. That was quite good for a little while, but there's still a trace of it, but it petered out. But the one time the Oxford group was big and famous and ever-present was the mid-30s, which is where Roland decided to go. He'd been to churches, he'd been to all these things, and he thought, maybe I'll go to the Oxford group, maybe I can get some spiritual insight anyway, because as he wrote later, he didn't think he could stay sober, but at least he wanted to stay sober long enough so his parents would have a pleasant memory of him when he died drunk. And he went to the Oxford movement in England, came back to New York finally, stayed sober, went to the Oxford movement there, no big deal, still very active. But the next, shortly thereafter that, middle 1934, early 1934, his parents were very pleased with him. He was staying sober, and they were so happy. So they said, why don't you and some of your little Oxford group friends go up to our country home in Vermont and have a little vacation? Because they were wealthy, so they sent them all up there for a little vacation, which is very important except for one thing. He just took a time at random. If he'd have gone 2 weeks earlier, we would not be in St. Lucia tonight. If he'd have gone 2 weeks later, most of us would be dead or insane. Just arbitrarily, he picked the right date to be with his friends in Vermont so that someone called attention to someone he had known named Ed Thatcher, who was known as Ebby. And they said, Ebby's having trouble with drinking. So Roland started giving him a little shot, so we went over to talk to him, and Ebby didn't want to hear about it. He said, thanks anyway, Roland, I'll let you know if I need trouble. Well, shortly thereafter, while he was still up there, Ebby had a stroke of bad luck. He drunkenly drove his car into somebody's living room. And so now he was going to be put away. And somebody said, oh, Roland, could you help poor Ebby? Now here's a little strange coincidence. One of the little Oxford group people that went up there with Roland was the son of the judge trying Ebby. So he went over and put a little clout with the judge. Roland said, you know me, judge. How about we take this guy out of here and we'll take him to New York and give him the Oxford group since we happen to be here. And the judge says, okay, my son says, oh, I know you, Roland. But he said, if he comes back to Vermont, he's going to be put away. So they took him in. Just think, if Roland hadn't happened to be there with that kid, that guy would have been put away and we'd all be dead. What was so important about Roland, finding Ebby? That's such a big deal about that. Because Ebby, for the extension of our lives, had to be brought to New York and get put in this Oxford movement. He liked it a little, but his motive wasn't terribly great. Roland now was trying to stay sober so his folks would have a pleasant memory of him. Ebby was in the Oxford movement to stay out of the Vermont State Penitentiary. Really a juggernaut of sincerity. And finally, they made a place called the Calvary Mission. It's an old mission in Manhattan where the Oxford group held forth. And Ebby was in there and they went to meetings. He told them about the principles. And then one day, Roland and a couple other guys told Ebby, now you've got to, one of the things we do here, we testify to others. And Ebby said, I don't want to testify to others. We don't care. That's what you're going to do. So who am I going to testify to? I'd be embarrassed to testify to anybody decent. So we happen to think he had another boyhood chum, bad drunk, fool, loser, quitter, who happened to be living in Brooklyn. So we got a hold of his address, got a hold of him and called on his chum, Bill Wilson. He went to Bill Wilson, and most of you know that story. He said, I'm straight and clean, and Bill Wilson said, oh, Jesus. Another religious puke. And he's sitting there. I found religion. Bill's reaction was, good. You won't drink any of my stuff tonight. So, hand me that bottle there behind you. That's really interesting. And Ebbie told him all this, and he didn't want to hear it, really. It just kind of bothered Ebbie, because although Ebbie wasn't a great zealot, he needed to be put down by a lower companion. So he went back to the Oxford group, and a couple of days he came back with the Oxford group closer, a guy named Shep. And Ebbie and Shep gave... And Bill Wilson reacted, and I hope the same way you and I would. Went off on the worst drunk of his career. Decided to go to the mission and tell him what he thought, and stopped for a few drinks down the way. And by the time he got there, he was just goofy drunk. Got in, and they had an altar call, and he went down to the altar and said a few words to one and all about the goddamn Oxford group, and just acted crazy and went home, goofy, lay in bed, sick, crazy. Decided to see if he'd get off this one. But his wife had credit enough for 4 bottles of beer in the store that they traded up to get those. Went to the town's hospital. And we all know the story. So a while later, early one morning, in the middle of the night, Bill Wilson turned out to be the one in a million who had a true spiritual transference, a spiritual experience. And he didn't know what it was, but as he wrote later, the rooms would be full of light and there's a wind. And they got the doctor, and he talked to the doctor for a long time. And the guys from the Oxford group came over and talked to him, and then he left. Now the good thing about Ebbie having found him, that even if he had a spiritual experience, there have been cases of people having spiritual experience, but when they get out of the hospital, wherever they have them, they usually go to a church. Bill associated somehow with Ebbie, so instead of going to the church, he went to the Oxford movement, and he became a member of the Oxford movement. And he felt he had been given this gift so he could carry a message of spiritual growth to alcoholics, to drunks. And for the next 6 months, he worked with drunks. He went to Oxford group. He'd find guys on the streets. He'd take them to the Oxford group meetings. Some of the Oxford group people weren't thrilled with it. And he'd bring them home and put them in the house, and he'd feed them. And his wife was having a difficult time. She'd barely been able to support the two of them. Now she had to support guests. Bill didn't work. Sounds a little cold, but it always works well in our family. The end of 6 months, one morning, the last guy he'd brought home had just got up early in the morning, stolen a chair to pawn and left. And he said to his wife, he said, "Let's get on with it. I'm not going to do this anymore. This does not work. I thought something was going wonderful, but it didn't work." And I'll tell you right then, your life and mine hung by the narrowest possible thread. It just, because she turned to him and said something that hardly anybody ever would have thought to say, but it changed the course of human history. She turned to him. I asked her a few years ago in Vermont. I was up there in Connecticut having lunch with her one day. I said, "Lois, how did you ever think of that answer? You changed the course of human history." She said, "I don't know, it just seemed quite obvious." When he said, "It doesn't work, nobody's staying sober," she says, "You're staying sober. First time you've ever stayed sober." And he said, "Oh yeah." And so he continued. Then we all know the story. He got a little job in Wall Street, and he got sent up to Akron, Ohio, to set up this proxy deal. And that went to hell in front of his eyes. He wound up coming back May morning, May 10th, and he walked into the Mayflower Hotel, and the whole deal had fallen through. He didn't have enough money to go back to New York. He had nothing. And he stood in that hotel lobby. I remember standing in that hotel lobby a few years ago trying to recreate this scene. Hot day, depressed, hopeless. Over there is a door with a sign over the neon sign says "Cocktails." And you can see inside. He started to make the move. And I'll tell you, another moment your life and mine hung by a thread. If he'd gone that 30 feet, we'd be dead. But then he remembered he had promised that these goofy Oxford group members, Sam Shoemaker, a guy in New York, had given him a list. So he went over the telephones on the wall like they had in small town hotels. And he looked up the name. The bottom name was Reverend Tunks, Episcopalian minister. So he called him up, said, "I'm a drunk from New York. Can I get some help?" And Reverend Tunks said, "I'm not a drunk, but I can, if you're an Oxford group member, I can give you a name of 10 Oxford group members." And he called them one after the other. And they hung up on him, and they said, "They don't know about alcoholism. They don't want to hear what you're drinking. Please don't bother." We get the feeling sometimes that he just made a call and went home. Bang, bang, bang. And I'll tell you, if that had been me, hot, discouraged, about the third person hanging up on me, that'd have been the end of my recovery, I think. But he kept on, got down to the last one, the 10th name, and he got a hold of some boob who said, "Well, I don't know, but I know a woman who does know. She has a doctor, I think, who's having some problems." So we got in touch with Henrietta Cyberly, non-alcoholic heiress. She invited him to come out and talk to her on Saturday afternoon, and they talked. And she said, "Well, I'd like to have you talk to my doctor." So she called the doctor, but she talked to the doctor's wife. The doctor just passed out under the table. So we'll set it up for tomorrow. So tomorrow we came back. In this little guest house, many of you have been there, Cyberling Mansion in Akron, doctor, his wife, two kids, showed up in Bill. The doctor said, "We didn't really want to hear it. I'll give you 15 minutes. Bill, he said, "I know you want to talk about the Oxford group." Dr. Bob had been a member of the Oxford group for 2.5 years. He was one of the spiritual leaders of the Oxford group in his area already, you know. "I'll give you 15 minutes, that's about all. I got to get home and worry." And he got talking and they called him aside. A spark set up. We all know what happened then. They talked a long time. And Dr. Bob, for some reason, hung on to him. And he said, "God, I hate, so good. I hate to ask you this, but could you stay a little while at our house? Now, Bill Wilson sit there without the train fare home." He says, "Yes, I can. I believe I can do that." So he moved into that house. And for the next 3 weeks, they just discussed Oxford group, and they went to Oxford group meetings, and they got involved. At the end of 3 weeks, as we know, the doctor said, "Boy, I didn't think I'd be able to go to the AMA meeting, but I'm going to go in Atlantic City, and I'm going to tell them what we found, Bill. You stay here and take care of my wife and kids, and we're going to show them." And off he went. He didn't hear anything from him. About 4 days later, the office nurse, Dr. Bob's office nurse, called up Mrs. Smith. Said, "Mrs. Smith, I got some bad news. They called me from the station this morning. Two porters carried the doctor off the train, dead drunk, put him on the platform. I went down and got him. He's here in the office, drunk on the floor. I'm so sad to tell you this. What can I do?" So Mrs. Smith and Dr. Bob, or Bill Wilson, went down to the office and got this drunken guy and took him home. Kept him there day after day, sick, desperate, ashamed, guilty. And it turns out Dr. Bob had told his wife, "You know, on Wednesday morning, or Thursday morning, I've got to do a cancer operation." He was a surgeon, proctologist, taking a rectal cancer out. And he said, "My God, look at my hand. I can't do that operation." So his sponsor did something for him that I knew about years later, and I asked my sponsor to do for me, and he wouldn't. His sponsor went down and got him a drink. He gave him a drink. He said, "Hang on to the knife now, Bob." And his hand settled down and he did the operation, and Ann and Bill went home. Okay, the operation's over. Now it's 3 hours later. They haven't heard from Dr. Bob, and they all know, oh, Jesus, he's drunk again. But it turns out Dr. Bob, as he's doing that operation, has had some kind of a surge about I'm going to give it a try. So after the operation, he went around to all the people he owed amends to in Akron and made amends on the way home. Got home sober. And we all, in Bill Wilson's state. And the day after that, they began to realize something. Bill Wilson had not stayed sober by absorbing spiritual information. As far as he could tell, he had stayed sober by trying to transmit to other drunks. Even though they didn't stay sober, he did. So he and Dr. Bob, on June 10th was the day that Dr. Bob sobered up the last time, had his last drink, and they decided to go call on somebody. But they didn't get around to it until, they had to find until June 28th. 18 days till Bob felt good enough to do it. They went up to the Akron City Hospital. They found some boob up there, defenseless. He was an ex-city alderman and an ex-official lawyer. He was from Kentucky. Moved to Akron. I heard him talk many, many years ago in a very thick accent. He says something effective. You know, everybody had been on him about his drinking for years. He's just so sick of hearing about his drinking. He said, my wife came in to me. She said, there are two fellas want to talk to me about my drinking. I thought, oh, hell. But she said that I'd help them fellas if I'd let them tell me about their drinking. I thought that's the least I could do for them, to help them. So they came in and they talked to me about their, they never talked to me about my drinking. They talked to me about their drinking. And I never heard anybody describe me so well. I was so impressed, I stuck with them fellas, and I've been with them ever since. And he became A number 3, and A number 4, little by little. They ended July, Lois saved a few pennies and took the train out to see how Bill was doing. She was so proud, happy, you know, staying sober. Later in the year, Bill went back to New York. We all know Akron had a pretty good base. They had what was called the Alcoholic Squadron. In the local Oxford group, Bill went back and started one in New York. He didn't have as much luck as Dr. Bob. And little by little, they grew. They had 18 good solid members a year later. In 1947, Bill Wilson had a few members having trouble. His big right-hand man was a guy named Hank P. And they were trying to keep it together in New York. And they were out. He and Dr. Bob sat down and said, what we got to do, we got to make our move. First of all, there are three things we got to do. We should write some kind of a book so people can won't misquote us. I don't know what we're going to put in them, but we've got to do something. Secondly, we should hire some kind of guys to act as missionaries to go around to tell people about what we're doing. And thirdly, we got to build some hospitals so we can treat alcoholics. We'll get them dough from somebody. And they, agreed that'd be a good idea. They couldn't hire the missionaries. They thought they could do that by the sale of the book. They couldn't build hospitals. They had to get that money somewhere. But they could write a book. So 1938, Bill Wilson sat down and wrote the book, which we read from tonight. We read from throughout the world. A book called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, we're all familiar with it. Say, what's the big deal about the book of Alcoholics Anonymous? When I got new, when I was new, I'm sure many of you had the same experience. When I was new, someone told me to read the book AA. Well, I was a writer. I've made my adult life living as a writer most of my adult life. It's kind of a common syndrome to say, well, when I came here, I read the book. I didn't think it was very well written. Ha, 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 ha. I read it. I didn't think it was badly written. I just thought it was terminally dull. Just endlessly, terminally dull. I write dynamic things. Do it now. Take this action. Bye. Ha, ha, ha. And there's nothing in this book you just read for hours. You are far up the stage of your development. You are. I didn't see how that could help me exactly. 7 years later, through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, I was on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And I got back at AA one more time. I had a new sponsor. And he had me read this book. And I smirked when I read it. And you and I discovered it was terminally dull. Endlessly dull. Never got anywhere. I just I really had to give up on the book. I mean, it might be help for simple people, but I've been cursed to the brain. And it wasn't until some time that I'd been sober for a while, taking actions and doing things under responsive guidance and being active in AA and staying sober. But little by little, over a period of time, I noticed something strange happened in my interpretation. I came to believe somewhere in the middle of my first 10 years, maybe 6, 7, 5, 6, 7 years, and I come to believe it, I believe it more implicitly today than ever. I have come to believe, against my early inclinations, that the book Alcoholics Anonymous, if not the only book, certainly is one of only two books that I firmly believe to be divinely inspired. I have little by little come to believe in that book as being divinely inspired. And there's a couple of good reasons for it. First of all, you got to remember this. The man did not know enough to write it. You got to remember that for 5,000 years there has been people attempting to work with alcoholics. And doctors and clergymen and psychologists and psychiatrists and well-meaning people. I have a great picture from 1860 in France. It shows a room about this size with a whole bunch of caskets, appearing to be caskets, but they're not. But they're shape of caskets with holes in the middle, and you just see faces. And up here is the doctors. Dr. Leclerc addresses a group of French alcoholics, just locked in little boxes. They always, nobody knows what to do with these fools, ever. And there's been efforts, and religious efforts, and people have given their all, and then nothing has ever been effective. Except the Washingtonian briefly, and they had nothing written really. And here's this guy, 3 years sober, surrounded by failure. Most of the people he had worked with were drunk. By far the majority of the people who came to AA in the version of it then were drunk. And he wrote a book that has changed more alcoholic lives in the last 51 years than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. Now that is miraculous. I know there are sometimes new people, they say things like, but God, he was sober 3 years. He should know enough to write a book by then. Let me give you some bad news if you're new. By the time you are 3 years sober, you will discover you are not able to write a book yet. By the time you are 5 years sober, you will find yourself patronizing people 3 years sober. Still going to meetings, Jimmy? Keep it up. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober to get your coffee. Was that two creams and one sugar, or two sugars and one? Oh, never mind, I'll get it, for Christ's sake. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober unattended on your property. Nothing personal, you want to say they're going to wind up? And here's this guy that wrote this book, and it was the biggest flop of the day, sold nothing. Try to get money, as we know from the Rockefellers. Rockefeller said, money will spoil your group, and they said, we'd like to spoil you, Mr. Rockefeller. Everything went to hell, but somehow they survived. Got some little article in Liberty Magazine in 1939 that went exactly opposite of what they were trying to do. They're trying to prove they weren't religious, and talked about AA, the new religion. They had a lot of difficulty because with the Oxford group, 38 and 39. Oxford group says, we're tired of you. The Oxford group, you got to remember, has a different aim than AA. Oxford group was, its goal was to get prominent people publicly saying they were in the Oxford group to get people to come and join and change their spiritual lives. And of course, AA's theory was anonymous. We don't do much of that. And they'd have little groups. And pretty soon, in some of these places, Oxford group, we're sure you're doing wonderful work with your alcoholics, but your friend just vomited on my shoe. I mean, I've come here to find spiritual resurgence, not to So they start having secret Alcoholic Anonymous meetings that were just alcoholic meetings after the Oxford meeting in New York. Then they had about Tuesday night, and instead of the Oxford group on Wednesday night. And in Akron, they begin to have a secret meeting after the Oxford group meeting. And in Cleveland, because they wanted to get Catholics in the AA there, they kind of detached themselves from the Oxford group and called themselves Alcoholics Anonymous after the name of this new book that had been written. And little by little it changed. But what's interesting about this is that this guy, Bill Wilson, was in many ways as weak and fragile as anyone in this room can be. And things were not working out. We know now afterwards it's easy to say, yes, it's all going to work out. But Joe was going through it. 1939, they couldn't pay for the book. His right-hand man, Hank P., got mad at Bill over a woman, got drunk. Not only got drunk, but went all around the country telling all the groups what a dirty, rotten SOB Bill Wilson was, to such extent that by the time in the late 40s, most of the nation's groups were still corresponding with Akron rather than New York. That's how strong the divergence was. There's a lot of heat. The Akron group was very upset with New York because they dropped the four Oxford group absolutes. Absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute love, absolute purity. Because Bill Wilson's theory is, we are perfectionists. If we have these things, it'll make us drunk. In Akron, they said, this is the only thing that'll make us whole. And on and on and on. Lost the dough from the Rockefellers. Everything's just going to hell. All of them. No money. Couldn't pay the rent. Dr. Bob is about to be evicted from his home in Akron. Bill Wilson was evicted from his home in New York. Nothing going on. And little by little they survived. They got a little dough. Rockefeller didn't give them the $50,000 they wanted for hospitals. But they got $4,000. Paid Dr. Bob's rent. Paid Bill Wilson's rent, paid a few little expenses, paid off someone who worked publishing company. Where that name comes from, incidentally, is the operative work in Akron was faith without works is dead, from the Gospel of St. Paul, and so they called it the Works Publishing. And in 1941, I had this article by Jack Alexander, made a payment, a lot of mail came in, things got better. 1939, AA began to form in other places. First group in Texas, in Houston. First AA meeting in Los Angeles. Let me tell you an interesting little anecdote about that. A little piece of trivia. A woman came to Los Angeles carrying the manuscript of the book. And she was an alcoholic, but her brother was. And he was sober, and she was going up to West Coast. She advertised in the Los Angeles Times, wives, do you have husbands who are drunkards? If so, contact me. And she got 12 wives to agree to come to a sleazy flea bag called the Hotel Cecil down on Main Street, bringing 12 husbands with them. They went on the mezzanine. You can still see the room where they met. These 12 guys went in there with the manuscript of the book, and the 12 wives sat out on the balcony outside the door, waited for them to be healed. And a guy named Morty Joseph, a guy I know, I did know he died, sat there and said, well, here's the table of contents. Maybe we should read this part, how it works. So he read chapter 5 for a while, then decided to discuss it. Whether by coincidence or whether by blinding celestial intervention, he had selected the 3 minutes that were the heart of AA. That's where the custom of reading chapter 5 comes from. Little by little, because Morty Joseph didn't know how to start an AA meeting in 1939. And eventually most of that group almost died. They almost all died out and got drunk, because that's what always happened. In fact, there's an interesting thing about the book. The things inside the narrative of the book were quite inspirational. But Bill Wilson's own opinions showed that he was still a callow newcomer. It says in the front, "We are a group of more than 100 men and women of faith over a year." He later admitted, to the best of his knowledge, there were only 79 people sober a year, but 100 had a more nice ring to it. Now, we all understand that. But he was certainly inspired. So, little by little, it came along. 1946, we talked about the other morning. Groups were going in all directions. People were dying. Everything was going to hell. People were selling memberships here, doing things bad there. And he decided he started to create the concept of the traditions. And he wrote the long form. In 1949, he reduced them to the short form so that people could understand them. But if any of you get a chance, you should read the long form. They make the traditions really worthwhile. And many of them are based on the experiences of the Washingtonians. What killed the Washingtonians? Bill Wilson had never heard of the Washingtonians until 1945 when some guy told him about it. And he looked into it and he started writing the traditions in 1946. And in 1950, they had the first international convention of AA made up of highly divergent elements. Everyone in Akron said, "We'll have it in Akron, the birthplace of AA." And in New York, they said, "We'll have it in New York, the fulcrum of the world." And the people in Akron said, "We ain't going to New York." And the people in New York said, "We ain't going to Akron." And they almost did not have a convention, because alcoholics then were like they are now. I'm sorry to report. And Bill and Dr. Bob got together, because they all seemed to get along together, and they finally agreed on Cleveland as a compromise. Okay, we'll go to Cleveland. They won't go to Akron. You know, the poor people. They went to Akron, they had, went into Cleveland, that interesting thing, the tapes of that convention are available. I mentioned this the other morning, I had the tapes home. What they tried to do is sell the traditions, because most of AA didn't want the traditions. We didn't want any laws. And that meeting, you can hear one after the other, they assigned one guy to take a tradition and talk for 10 minutes to try to convince people it wasn't harmful. Then the second guy took the second tradition, and 12 men took 12 traditions, and finally, to be understandable, they accepted them. And most of us remember, that's where Dr. Bob, dying of cancer, was brought to the podium. Gave that little talk that has been of such help to many people, very short, on how, let us not get ourselves all loused up with scientific stuff that's of interest to scientists. And he said a great line, he said, and it's really true today. When it's boiled down to his last analysis, AA is love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And he died. And here, he died a few months later. Interesting thing. These founders of ours were great people, but they were quite very human. Very human. Very much bedeviled in many ways. Dr. Bob, for example, and Bill Wilson, absolutely divergent types. There's an old saying, it's an apocryphal saying, but it really has a basis of truth. If Dr. Bob had been the only founder of AA, you would still have to go to the King School in Akron to go to a meeting. Because that's the only place he would be. If Bill Wilson had been the only founder of AA, he would have sold it in 1939. But between them, there was an exquisite balance. One of the things that Bill Wilson had planned in the late 1940s, he had planned what kind of a gravestone he would have, what he would put on it, had some epitaphs. And Dr. Bob died and spoiled all of it. He put on his, Dr. Robert Smith, born and died, that's all. And so, it's kind of an interesting thing, up in the little Vermont cemetery where Bill is buried, he has an even smaller one. He has out-humbled Dr. Bob. It's William Wilson, born and died, that's all. You know, can't even find it. I was up there struggling. It's just in the middle of a country graveyard, nowhere. But here's an interesting insight. And this is not certainly put down, because I revere these men because they were so human and did such wonderful things. If they were godlike creatures, none of us would be helped. There would just be some more wonderfulness. In 1970, I was at the International Convention, I was pleased to be able to talk that day on July 4th. And the night before, we were all excited on Friday night because Bill Wilson, we knew was dying, but he was going to speak at the International Convention. And there were 15,000 people at this Miami Beach Convention Center. We were excited. And the guy came on and said, "Sorry, Bill is too sick to talk. Replace him with somebody else." They did. And we realized it was sad, but we thought, damn it, you know, I want so much to hear, because I've heard Bill a number of times. I talked to the life in his office, I had a great admiration for his fallibility. And a friend of mine from Pittsburgh, who had been an Oxford group member and an early member with Dr. Bob's group, we got back to the hotel and said, "Listen, I know Bill is dying, but he's going to talk at this convention." I said, "How do you know that, McHugh? You know, what do you mean? He's going to die talking at this convention. We may never hear him again." He said, "Mark my words." So we waited Saturday night, no Bill Wilson. Sunday morning, we had a speaker going. Guy came out, stopped the meeting. So I'm very happy to announce that Bill is here to say a few words. We wheeled him out in the wheelchair. He had tubes out his nose and all of them. He stood up, talked a little bit about, "We must keep AA together so we don't fracture ourselves and come apart to kill us." And he's quite dynamic, so he ran out of breath and he had bad emphysema. Couldn't breathe, and he sat down again, and they wheeled him away, and nobody ever saw him again. And he died a few months. And I said to McHugh later, I said, "How in the world, why were you so sure he was going to talk?" He said, "Because you got to remember, these are human beings. Bill wouldn't want said that Dr. Bob talked while he was dying." True story. And AA has had a lot of, they started the General Service Conference, most of us know, in 1951, in the face of a lot of problems. They had grown little by little. It's now almost everywhere. And the biggest battle of AA today is the same battle as it was for the guys in Akron, Ohio, I guess, is that no matter how big and wonderful and impressive it gets, there are certain basic principles that must be taken by people who do not choose to take them. Because the argument of what is Alcoholics Anonymous is always the same. You hear all the definitions, Alcoholics and Fellowship, men and women, true. But what is Alcoholics Anonymous? Is it a convention? Is it a trip to St. Lucia? Is it a meeting? Is it going into a hospital? Is it being of service? Is it being a delegate to New York? It's none of these things. It's not a book. These are all tools that we use with Alcoholics Anonymous. But what Alcoholics Anonymous is tonight is exactly the same thing it was on June 10th, 1935. It is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being different at least enough so that he will begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And that's what it always is, because the unifying factor of all of us is our terrible feeling of difference. And that's why again and again we've been impressed by the singleness of purpose. The last things Bill Wilson wrote before he died was again to reinforce that. You must be an alcoholic. A non-alcoholic cannot be an Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a contradiction in terms. You can attend open meetings, but you may be an alcoholic and have other problems, but you must be an alcoholic. Why must you be an alcoholic? Because the premise here is one talking to another to reduce the feelings of difference, not to accentuate it. That's why AA has always traditionally been against special interest meetings. What's wrong with a bunch of actors sitting together? And wouldn't that be better than just the interspersed with ditch diggers? Or a bunch of lawyers or doctors or pilots? And there's nothing wrong with it, I guess, in a sense. I'm sure Paul feels this way. As a doctor, he's a member of IDAA, International Action Day. It's fine. to get people in so they're not afraid. But they must eventually move on into AA. Because the whole premise of AA is to help people overcome that terrible feelings of difference. When you sit in a special interest group with other people like yourself, you reinforce your feelings of being different. Yes, we pilots do have different problems than they do. Yes, we lawyers do have a different problem than they do. Yes, we actors. And the ones who stay in those special interest groups almost invariably get drunk again. Happens all the time. It is overcoming those feelings of difference. And that's why sometimes AA seems like a fuddy-duddy group, and sometimes where they get seem old-fashioned with these traditions. And why do you have to be an alcoholic? Because this is the basic premise of the only thing that has ever worked this long and in this degree for alcoholics in the history of mankind. It's always funny. Every so often, somebody doesn't like it. When I was new, I was about 5 years sober. There's a terrible scathing attack on AA and Harper's called AA Culture Cure, and he just ripped up AA, and 2 years later he ripped into him in the Saturday Evening Post. A guy named Kane, Arthur Kane, and I met him in 1940, about a year later. He was on the TV station that I was working on. He came out to do a program, and I discovered something funny. He became understandable. He was a 9-year slipper in New York. And every time he got drunk, he got mad at AA and wrote another article. But he made it very technical. He was a doctor of philosophy. He was a very bright man. He was just, when he got drunk and wrote an article, but after the article came out, he wrote a letter of apology and amends to Bill Wilson, which is in the archives in New York. But a lot of people read that. A lot of 1964, another article appeared in some of the magazine. AA has been under attack from a lot of places. In Akron, Ohio, the birthplace of AA, there's a little group of apostates now who say, AA has become different than it was in the old days. Let's get back to the real AA. And they found the copyright on the book had not been renewed and snatched up the copyright on the book Alcoholics Anonymous. In Montreal, they were selling bootlegged AA copies because they now had the copyright. And AA had to deal with them. Because we don't become saint-like people. This whole week that we've talked and heard African speakers, Jean, Paul, Maxine, the morning meetings, the afternoon meetings, the southern group, all the people here have talked, and we discussed things, the moonlight meeting, discussing various phases of what the AA program's about. But it's sometimes hard to remember that if we do not cherish and keep this thing the way it is, we won't have anything. That's why we have to carry this with a great deal of... We must cherish this with a great deal. One of the parts of the book that Bill Wilson felt bad about and tried to edit again and again because he felt it was just too religious. He didn't want to leave people with a bad taste in their mouth. Is the part that we read in the meetings all the time now, the end of the first 164 pages, which says, God will constantly, you will certainly meet some of us who trudge this road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. One of the reasons he put in the stories so it wouldn't end on that religious note, because they were just baffled and going blindly and going through. And most of them got drunk. Of the first 79 they talked about, most of them died drunk. People have been dying drunk around here forever. Coming and sitting in an AA meeting and looking wise won't keep you sober. That's why we have to keep doing these things and reinforcing them. That's why old-timers get drunk. My sponsor told me when I was new, if you don't do these things, you'll get drunk. I said, oh, really? And the next year he stopped doing them and he got drunk and died. And people thought I should be depressed. I said, no, proves what he said was right. True story. Stop and think about it. There have been literally millions of sober alcoholics in AA. Every meeting you go to, there are newcomers. You stop to think. Every week there are newcomers. There shouldn't be halls big enough to hold us. But there are, because most don't stay long enough to discover that AA is more than getting sober. Some get here, especially these days, so full of psychobabble, they think they've taken the steps in the 28 days they were in that treatment facility. They think that's the end of the AA therapy. Some come here and rise to such spiritual heights, they float right off the top of AA. Don't you go to meetings anymore? I no longer need meetings. I walk with my partner. And one day his partner gives him a martini, and here he comes. You and I have the same, you know, AA is big and successful in a lot of things. But it got here by such a funny little series of coincidences that the biggest battle you and I have to do today is remember, we can't take this for granted. That a guy, God, and incidentally, Roland, here's an interesting little piece of trivia. He never went to AA. He used to live in the Oxford group. Roland died in 1943. To this day, his family has refused to announce the cause of his death. Most people think he got drunk one more time, because alcoholics get drunk. No matter how wonderful you are, you get drunk. Ebby, the man who carried the message, got drunk and sober and drunk and sober and drunk. I heard him speak in 1960, the International Convention. Bill Wilson cherished him as if Ebby had been sober 7 years, long as he's ever been sober. So I want to introduce my sponsor. Ebby came up and talked for a while. He seemed to have kind of a sardonic attitude. And a year later, he got drunk. I was talking to somebody in Texas where he lived. I said, what the hell did that guy get drunk for? Christ, he's such a legend. He never could understand why Bill Wilson gets all the attention and he doesn't. He was supposed to be Bill Wilson's sponsor. Human beings sitting there grinding, completely oblivious to the fact that he'd been drunk most of the time. And Bill Wilson was so, that Bill, I carried the message to him. How come he's getting all this juice? And it's just an amazing thing. And AA is really short. I'm going to close down and say, it's amazing to think how short AA is. If you renew 55 years, that'll last forever. When I was young, like you guys, I remember going to the International Convention, as I say, my first one in 1960. Not very many people, held outside the Long Beach football stadium. How informal it was. A bunch of us were milling around outside waiting to get in. And I said, we need some ushers. Anybody want to be an usher? And I did. I was a year and a half sober, and I was sick of it already. And then my friend Keith, I said, I'll be an usher. So they came in and gave us a blue armband, said usher. Said, take old people down to the front seats. All right. So I got an old lady, first one in, and took her to the front seat, sat her down, took off my armband, sat next to her. You know, But that night changed my life. Because I, you know, it's hard to remember this now. But there's Bill Wilson telling his story. And he's introducing Sam Shoemaker and Father Ed Dowling and his wife, Lois, who gives a talk. And it went on and on. And Ebby gets up and gives a talk. It was like being at the during the Battle of Gettysburg and seeing the original cast. I mean, it's just, it, I came out of there crying. I've been hearing all this stuff for so many years, it just came alive. But I'll tell you what happens in AA. Here's something that happens. Bill talked a long time, and it got kind of cold out there in that open football field. And I noticed some of the grand dragons and old broads and well-dressed men in the front rows were going, got cold. And finally, they were getting up and leaving while he was talking. And I was just upset. I just felt like screaming, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. You wouldn't be alive if it weren't for that guy. Now you're a little cold, are you, for Christ's sake? I felt like shouting, talk all night, girl! Where's this chair in the front row, you know? Okay. We'll skip ahead to 5 years later. Toronto Maple Leaf Garden, Friday night, big meeting, Bill Wilson talking, his wife is there, his friends are there. I'm now working in a TV station in Los Angeles. I'm hip and slick, I got a shiny suit, and I'm feeling wonderful. And he keeps talking, and he keeps talking. I thought, Jesus, Bill. I wanted to meet somebody at the hotel, for Christ's sake. I mean, we're interested, but knock it off, will you? I thought, that's what happens in AA. AA doesn't change. My perceptions change. I get blasé, I get carried away, When people say, it isn't sincere the way it used to be, it means I'm not doing the things I used to do. So we have to keep reinforcing and keep changing. Once upon a time, a guy wrote to Bill Wilson and said, why do you have the word surrender again and again in AA? Shouldn't we just have one surrender? And he wrote back the letters in the archives. He said, most of us, nearly all of us, cannot surrender. We cannot surrender all the time. He said, I think I was able to, but could you call us to mind the last thing? Only one step has been changed since the book was published. That is the 12th step. If you ever look at volume 1, the first edition, which is step 12, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. After the book came out, there was quite a hubbub in Akron and New York. And people came to Bill and said, Bill, that's wrong. He said, why is it wrong? He said, well, you're the only one who's ever had a spiritual experience. We never have. And it didn't happen to you as a result of the steps. It happened to you 3 years before you wrote the steps. And that doesn't seem right. He said, that's right. And they discussed this for a long time. Fortunately, the book sold very slow. They had a lot of time to discuss it before the second edition. But they finally decided, that's right. What AA does, the spiritual experience that Dr. Jung talks about, and they still have to have it. But hardly anybody gets it the way Bill Wilson gets it. But AA is designed for is something different. It is not the whom, it's the make amends to who? It's a gradual process. You get to the same place, you're still going to be sober. So they changed that step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. That's where it came from. And so we continue to seek that awakening, to seek to continue to reinforce one another's belief here, so we will continue to take the actions that will keep us here. You know, sometimes if you're new, it's not like all the old timers say, I came to AA and I threw in the towel and I've been wonderful ever since. That isn't the way human beings do. I'll tell you how they do. Just like you. You come here and you throw in the towel and the first chance you get, you snatch it back and you spend the rest of your life trying to tear off small pieces and see if that'll satisfy the dirty bastards. But we do all these things for what? So we become wonderful, so we become perfect, so we become grand. This morning we were talking about perfectionism at that early morning meeting on the range and the great follow-ups. You've got to remember, just like Bill Wilson with inspiration, surrounded by Oxford Group talking about four absolutes and perfectionists and his own terrible drive, wrote the most meaningful help for you and I as fallible people who ever here. What an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And then he goes down at the end and says, surely, trudge this road of happy destiny. Surely you'll meet many of us as you trudge this road of happy destiny. And certainly a great thought for all of us to say to one another as long as we live. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.